So before starting, I'd like to recognize a large number of collaborators that have been involved in not just the work I'm talking about, but also a lot of discussions about this physics. In particular, this is work that's collaborative with Arun Paramakanti here in this department, and will feature in large part work done in the Ketterly Lab at MIT, and other names will come up as we go along. In my group, there's a large number of people working on exciting experiments, most of which I won't discuss today. Mostly I'll be focusing on theoretical work done here by Lindsay LeBlanc, along with Arun and Anton Berkoff at Waterloo, and then experimental work at MIT along the same lines. So our story starts in a very bucolic scene in Greece with the shepherd Magnus, who was, story has it, wandering through the fields and noticed that the tip of his cane became kind of stuck on the ground. He dug into the ground and unearthed a strange rock which seems to attract the tip of his cane, and that became a magnet. That was the first magnet. So this is, you know, we physicists dream of being in the field and just letting our thoughts wander and our imagination go, and that worked 4,000 years ago. 3,000 years ago. So on the other hand, you might think this is a problem, magnetism, which is relevant to all of us, not least because we live on a magnet. The Earth is a weak magnet, but a very large one. And that was understood in the 1600s. And these are just the first two steps in a very long history of magnetism, which seems to involve almost every name I know in physics. And I've left off basically all the 20th century contributors after 1930 along the lines here. So magnetism was at first considered an oddity, and then it was understood how to connect magnetism to electricity and to electric fields. Of course, we now know this is part of an electroweak unified theory, and we also know that the theory of materials which exhibit magnetism is quite intricate and rich. One thing that's wonderful about magnets is all the things we can do about them. And I can tell you about these examples, but there's really one example that maybe some of you have with you. Let's see. What's in my pockets? Yes, here, I always carry a magnet with me. Maybe some of you do too. And if you haven't, you should take out the headphones in your pocket or around your neck if you're like some of the grad students I see working on their experiments with ear pods in. Like, I can give my talk like this, actually. But you'll feel the repulsion between the ferromagnets that sit in your headphones. And, of course, this leads to wonderful things. All right, so that's how I really know you care about magnets. And I'm sure that's what brought you all to this talk. All right, now, magnetism in materials is not simple. In an isolated atom, you can look at an isolated magnet as a single dipole, and you would expect that it's a paramagnet. But at extremely high fields, a diamagnetic effect can occur, and that's only visible when all the electrons are essentially paired and paramagnetism doesn't appear. And so in bulk materials, these either para or diamagnetic characters mean that something is either attracted to or repelled by a field. That's not the magnetic property I want to talk about today. I want to talk about permanent magnetism, ferromagnetism, and that is a result of Fermi statistics and electron interactions, as we'll talk about in a moment. Those same ingredients can lead to a slightly different behavior, anti-ferromagnetism, but even though that's quite common in materials, it's not as easily discernible. In other words, Magnus the Shepherd would have never known there was an anti-ferromagnet buried in the field. You need to do a more sophisticated 20th century type analysis. So what is ferromagnetism? Just here's a very basic picture of ferromagnetism, which is, let's consider how to arrange four particles into the levels of a simple harmonic oscillator. We consider levels that are spaced by h bar omega. And then every time there is a particle with one that is not of its spin type, so blue seeing a green, we say it has an interaction energy, E interaction here. Now, I'm assuming in this kind of arrangement that we have fermions. Fermions which are identical cannot interact. So only the interaction between blue and red, between spin up and spin down, two unlike types of fermions, will be included in this kind of interaction energy term. And now you want to ask, what is the minimum energy configuration for these four particles? Do I want to mix them into the lowest states of the well, or do I want to line them all up to avoid the interaction energy? Over here, when they're all blue, there's no interaction energy. Over here, in a mixture, you have both single particle energy, both the lowest energy here and then 1 h bar omega more. And if you just count up what's the energy here, what's the energy there, you find that this is 6 h bar omega, and this is 4 h bar omega plus 4 e interacting. You can draw out these configurations on a piece of paper and count them up. Basically, the distinction between whether this one or this one is the lowest energy configuration occurs when this interaction energy is equal to h bar omega. And so this already tells you something really important, that in order to have this kind of alignment, which is what we see in a ferromagnet, where all the spins want to be pointing in the same direction, we have to have an interaction energy per particle which is comparable to the free particle energy. And that's a regime which is called strongly interacting. It's a regime where when you try to do a perturbation theory approach where you start with the well-known states of the free gas and then you add a little bit of interaction, that kind of treatment is going to break down once those interaction energies are comparable to the free particle energies. So already in this very simple picture, you can guess that this is going to be a hard problem. Now, if you look into materials and you ask what ingredients do you find in pretty much every material you see that is ferromagnetic, you see that there are fermions. There are unpaired electrons with some spin. Those fermions have a repulsion because of their charge, and they sit in a lattice. And in the simple picture I just explained to you, I use these first two properties. But in basically every material you can think of, you also get the third. And the question I want to ask today is, do you need a lattice? Do you need all three of these typically occurring ingredients, or can ferromagnetism be created with just these two very simple ingredients? So that's the question I want to ask you today. What is the simplest condition in which you can observe permanent magnetism? To address this question, I want to talk about ultra-cold atoms. I'm going to use ultra-cold atoms. Ultra-cold atoms are neutral gases that are cooled to quantum degeneracy. And when that particle is a boson, when its total spin integer is an integer, then it forms a Bose-Einstein condensate. When those particles are fermions, you get a degenerate Fermi gas, like an electron C. We can choose a lot of things about ultra-cold atoms. You can choose what mixture of states. You can choose what kind of environment you would like to look at. And you can tune the interaction between atoms, between infinitely repulsive and infinitely attractive. So, in short, this is really a fun sandbox for physicists. It's really a great place to play to ask fundamental questions. So let me go through some of these properties, tell you just a very small amount about how to form ultra-cold atoms, and then I'll return to the question of ferromagnetism and how do we think about it. So I told you that you can either have bosons or fermions. And for people who have not taken statistical physics, let me just quickly say what that means so you're not lost in the rest of the talk. By a boson, I mean a kind of particle which is social. It likes to be with its friends, and if you get it cold enough, bosons collect together at the lowest possible energy in the system, and they form a Bose-Einstein condensate. By a fermion, I mean a kind of anti-social particle that can't stand to do what everyone else does. It has to do something different. And so that means if you put them into states of a system, you're only going to get one particle per system, one particle per state. And now you know examples of both of these types of particles. You know that the periodic table is filling up the orbitals of an atom with electrons, and every type of atom is distinct because of the electron orbitals that are occupied. And you may know something about lasers, like the laser I'm using now. Coming out of this laser pointer are photons, which are all in the same state. They're going in the same direction, they have the same polarization, and they're at the same frequency. So slightly more exotic examples of these are superfluids, owe their marvelous properties to bosonic physics. And protons and neutrons are fermions. The stability of neutron stars, for instance, is due to Fermi statistics. The star cannot collapse because if it were to do so, states would start to overlap, and that's forbidden. Bosons and fermions you may not have heard of before are composite bosons like rubidium-87 and composite fermions like potassium-40, and these are alkali gases, both of which, for instance, are cold in the basement with McLennan. So how cold do you have to be? I keep saying ultra-cold. What do I mean? Why do I say ultra-cold? Einstein's criterion for quantum degeneracy is that you have one particle per cubic de Broglie wavelength. So the number density times the de Broglie wavelength cubed needs to be greater than or equal to 1. If you look at what the left-hand side of this inequality is, it scales like density to the 2/3 and temperature to the 3/2. So now if I'm considering, let's say, going from superfluid helium to a gas, I'm about a billion times less dense, and that means I need to be a million times colder than liquid helium to get to quantum degeneracy. In real numbers, that means we have to be at about 500 nanokelvin. So that's about a billion times colder than this room. This was first done in 1995 at Boulder, Colorado, at JILA, by Carl Wieman and Eric Cornell, and later that summer by Wolfgang Ketterle. The three of them were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2001 for this step. What was measured in the first summer is a temperature of around 200 nanokelvin at a density that's quite comparable to a gas density. And this particle, rubidium-87 that was used, had a scattering length of 5 nanometers, in other words, a scattering cross-section of about that number squared, and those are for atoms that are more or less 2 nanometers in size. So let me talk a little bit about the collisions and what I mean by that A parameter. At low energy, only the L equals 0 partial wave contributes to scattering. What that means is that the cross-section can be written as 4 pi A squared for non-identical particles, and it's only this part, this wave, which contributes in cold gases, because the angular momentum, when you consider what is the angular momentum compared to h, comparable to h bar, that means that the de Broglie wavelength, which is h over p, is greater than d or much greater than the size of the atom. So what that means is that a very nasty interatomic potential, which might have many bound states and could describe, say, the bonding of crystals and surfaces stuck with atoms. These are very complicated interatomic potentials. No matter how messy this potential may be, you can replace it with a very simple potential, a contact potential whose value is only non-zero when two particles are at the same position, with a prefactor 4 pi h bar squared a, this is the scattering length, over m, the mass of the particle. Okay, so any potential with this that gives us this the same phase after a scattering event is equivalent when you're only considering the S wave potential, the S wave partial wave, and let's just choose an easy one, and that's this contact potential. That's a tremendous simplification, because in solids and in liquids, part of the difficulty of doing a first principles model and then getting to physics is we have to model the interactions between, say, liquid particles. And what you typically end up doing is making measurements on the material and putting empirical parameters into your model. In this case, the model can be very simple with only a single parameter. Now, this parameter still has to be measured. It still requires precise photo association spectroscopy to determine the scattering length A for rubidium 87, for instance, because we can't solve the 87 or the 39 fermion problem of what electron orbitals look like precisely. So fermions are just that difficult to deal with. Even a single atom has states which are not well enough defined to figure out what two of them would look like scattering together, much less 10 to the 23 of them in a solid. Okay, now how do we get cold? The first step in getting cold is laser cooling. And so this is a diagram of what laser cooling looks like in an apparatus. This cube here is a cube of glass inside of which is a high vacuum. We shine these lasers onto a cloud and we do laser cooling. Laser cooling seems a little strange. You walk out on a sunny day and you warm up. So why is it that if I point the laser at me, I should get colder? You know, I don't feel colder with a laser pointing at me. Why would laser cooling ever work for an atom? And the answer is it only works for a very special detuning when you can use the fact that a laser beam is in some sense cold. If you believe that entropy is randomness and randomness is heat, then the fact that all the photons coming out of this laser pointer are in the same state means that it's very cold. It has little entropy and very little heat. And so what's happening in laser cooling is that you send laser beams in towards an atomic cloud, the atomic cloud gets colder, and the light field gets hotter. So that seems, okay, that's a plausibility argument. I'm telling you laser cooling could happen. But actually, to make it happen, you can ask me afterwards, and I can tell you a little more about the details. One thing that's great about laser cooling is it makes for good pictures. Here's a photograph of the cell in the basement. This is that glass cell I mentioned to you. This is a cloud of about 10 to the 9 rubidium atoms at a few hundred microkelvin. Not to be outdone, at MIT, they use different colors, and their experiment is also beautiful. One thing you might ask me is, won't this gas just freeze? I mean, why is it that I can get the gas cold, and it doesn't just turn into a lump of rubidium? You might ask that question if you're thinking about a phase diagram. Here's a typical phase diagram with pressure on one axis and temperature on the other. And you know that at low enough temperature, when I go this way in this diagram, eventually I'm going to get to a solid. The only element known that doesn't go to a solid when you move towards zero temperature is helium, and we're not working with helium. So why is it that I'm talking about very cold rubidium or very cold lithium or potassium, these funny alkali gases? Well, this is the response to that question. Eric Cornell said, if it were really impossible, they wouldn't have bothered to forbid it. This is only a forbidden region. It's not really impossible. And the key to this is metastability. So in fact, a Bose-Einstein condensate, for instance, is not in equilibrium. And this diagram I'm showing you here is an equilibrium phase diagram. So the question is, how slowly is it dying? How slowly are we forming a solid in this gas? And you can estimate that by looking at a loss rate, gamma, which was proportional to the density squared. Now, what I need to do is have this loss rate here be low enough that I have time to do an experiment before everything is Jackson Pollock on the bottom of the glass cell. And what does that mean? I have to still have a thermal equilibrium within the gas. So I still need a little bit of density. I can't just take this density to zero. So if I need some kind of collision rate, this is the density times the cross-section times the average collision velocity, and I combine that with the criterion that I want quantum degeneracy, the only parameter left is temperature. So you find that temperature must be less than this combination of all these coefficients, and that's about 15 microkelvin. So if you know how quickly a gas will relax the equilibrium, you can figure out that you've got to be ultra-cold. You've got to be at a microkelvin or so in order to do an experiment. And typically, we're at less than a microkelvin. Now, one wonderful thing about gases that wasn't realized at first but is really a center to the research right now is that I can choose whether I have weak or strong interactions between gases. Now, when I say weakly or strongly interacting, I'm asking about the product of density times the scattering length cubed. Again, does it look like it's a traffic jam in the collisions, or are particles free to move quite a while before they hit another one? You can tune this scattering length by taking the atomic state and tuning it near a molecular resonance. And the reason is because the bound state of two particles together has a slightly different magnetic moment than independently the sum of two energies of two free particles traveling by each other. So applying a magnetic field, we can move along the relative energy of the atomic states in a molecular state, and at some magic field for any pair of states, we get what's called a Feshbach resonance. So here I'm showing you experimental data of a scattering cross-section versus ambient magnetic field taken by Debbie Jin's group and Jilla. And you can see here's a theoretical curve that there should be a dispersion here. You can see that the data is across several orders of magnitude in cross-section. And this was really the first observation of this. And since then, there have been a tremendous array of elements showing these Feshbach resonances. And we've shown that we can tune the scattering length by 10 to the 4, at least, perhaps 10 to the 5. And so that's lovely. That's like taking two electrons and telling you, I can tune the charge, which is hard to do. In lithium-6, the element I'm going to talk about that's used at MIT, in order to use this magnetic field as a tuning parameter, you need to form a trap without the magnetic field. Sometimes you can make a magnetic bottle that holds atoms. In this case, what we need to do is use an optical field to trap the atoms and then put them in the two lowest states of lithium. So here I'm showing you energy measured in megahertz versus magnetic field. And these two lowest states here of the six ground states of lithium are used. And so for most of the rest of this talk, I'm just going to talk about these two as if they were spin up and spin down. But let me just comment briefly on the atomic physics. I know Daniel would want me to do that. This splitting here is a hyperfine splitting. And then for low field, you see a linear Zeeman effect. For high field, the electron and nuclear spin decouple. And so all of these are basically electron spin down. All of these are electron spin up. And the differences between them are what's happening with the nuclear spin. So I'll come back to this. But when I say spin up and spin down in the neutral atom case, I might as well be saying red and blue. It's really just two different states. Now these lithium atoms can be tuned in their interaction with the Feshbach resonance. And if you start over here with atoms and you make the interaction more and more attractive, what happens eventually if you take two particles and you make a stronger and stronger attraction between them is they form a molecule, quite simply. And so atoms which were free over here when the magnetic field is swept through this Feshbach resonance forms stable molecules. If these were fermions, you take two fermions and you pair them, you get a composite boson. And that boson can and has been seen to make a Bose-Einstein condensate itself, except a molecular Bose condensate. And for several years, maybe between 2002 and 2009, our field was really working on this transition here, this so-called BCS, because superfluidity is observed here in a BCS-type way, to BEC crossover. And what we realized in this work is that if you just prepare the states differently, coming from this side, there's a way here to make a very repulsive gas, which is not the same state down here as these molecules. The reason no one had really seen this before is partially because this is a very short-lived state. And I'll come back to that. But OK, so now let me give you the comparison here, comparing what we do in condensed matter and what we do in atomic physics. In condensed matter, the show is the electron. Here, I'm going to be talking about an atom, which is a composite fermion instead of a fundamental fermion. The electrons are charged. They interact with a Coulomb interaction. That Coulomb interaction is often screened and can be thought of as a short-range interaction. Neutral particles are much shorter range. They're intrinsically short range. And we're going to model this as a contact interaction, which is sometimes a good model for electrons, sometimes not. The ferromagnetic materials that we're talking about all come in a crystal environment. But in the gas, we can trap it, but we don't need to apply a lattice. So we can choose that ingredient we were wondering about. Do we need a lattice? Do we not need a lattice? Can we still see a similar type of transition? Materials often have Curie points of above 300 Kelvin, above room temperature. That means you can have a room temperature ferromagnet. Here we're going to have to work at less than 300 nanokelvin. These materials are found naturally, although you can fabricate some wonderful magnets. This is very unnatural. You know, this only happens at the coldest spot in the universe, and that means that you can make money off of this one, and this one only takes money. Okay, so the model I want to talk about now is something called stoner ferromagnetism. And this is really a simple model. I mean, this is really the spherical cow of ferromagnetism. And it has very simple ingredients. This is a Hamiltonian where you integrate over all space, you integrate the kinetic energy of the particles, and you add a contact interaction here. So now I'm considering cold atoms, fermions in two different states, which I'm going to call spin up and spin down. They have this repulsive interaction whose coefficient G is tunable, as I mentioned to you, and there's no lattice. And what we're looking for is a transition where we start with a mixture of atoms in a trap, and then we increase the interaction strength, and as we intercross it, and as that happens, we're looking for a domain formation. So we're looking for a domain formation because the number of particles that are spin down and the number of particles that are spin up is fixed in this experiment. Unlike in materials, there's no spin orbit interaction that allows electrons to choose the lowest energy by flipping their spins. If I start the experiment with 75% of the atoms in spin up, at the end of the experiment, 75% will be in spin up. And so the only thing they can do in order to be ferromagnetic is to locally polarized, locally line up. And as we mentioned earlier, that means the Fermi energy, the maximum occupied state, will go up. And that's going to be a favorable state when the kinetic energy cost of polarizing is less than the interaction energy cost of remaining mixed. So now you can treat this in the simplest way possible, which is thinking of the interactions in a mean field approximation. And if you don't know what that is, I'm not going to explain it to you in much detail, other than to say you consider more or less one particle, and the sea of other particles around it are kind of averaged out. Whatever they do is considered just a potential that may as well be a magnetic or optical potential. It doesn't fluctuate. So mean field type treatments ignore fluctuations, but they are simple, and they often give you a qualitative picture of what may happen. If you do that for a uniform 3D system, you can write down the energy, the total energy, in the following way. Everything scales like the Fermi energy, and then you have magnetization. That's this lowercase m. And so the kinetic energy is determined by the kinetic energy of all the spin ups and the kinetic energy of all the spin downs. So here's spin ups, and here are spin downs, and then again you have this interaction term. So notice that if the magnetization goes all the way to 1, if things polarize completely, then this interaction term here goes to 0. And when would that happen? If we look at the coefficient on the interaction strength, the Fermi vector times the scattering length is a nice non-dimensional parameter to use, KFA. So if KFA gets strong enough, you see that at some magic point where KFA is pi over 2, the magnetization of the minimal energy becomes non-zero. So a quantitative treatment, although a mean field treatment, of this Hamiltonian tells you that if the coefficient here and the interaction is strong enough, there is a spontaneous magnetization where this m drops from 0 up to 1. So now, along with Lindsay and Anton Birkhoff, Arun Paramakanti, we looked at, let's assume this is a good model. Let's just believe that the spherical cow is going to utter something wise to us about ferromagnetism. And And now, let's look at what the energy is. The energy is this integrated over all space, and we have to make it a little more complicated to model the experimental situation because we hold these atoms in a trap. So there's going to be not only what the terms I showed you in the previous slide, but also now a potential energy. And we're going to ask at various interaction strengths, at various KFA, what happens in the trap. And you see that for strong enough KFA, there's a density of spin up and there's a density of spin down, which are different from one another. At low enough interaction strength, everything stays polarized altogether, unpolarized altogether. And interestingly, there are two ways in three dimensions you could think about a magnetization occurring. One of them we're going to call the hedgehog, okay? And that means that the spins kind of point out from the center of the trap radially in all directions. And so that means locally at any one place, the spins are pretty much aligned. So the interaction energy isn't very strong. But then if I sum over all of them, there's going to be down and up all together. So the total spin is still going to be balanced, spin up and spin down. The total population is fixed. Another way you might imagine satisfying that same constraint is having a kind of donut, where on the outside, in three dimensions, okay, a shell is formed with everything in spin up, and then the inside it's all spin down, and then you choose the radius at which you convert from one to the other so that the total volume in each of those is the same. So these are two possibilities. You could form a hedgehog or you could form a domain wall, and now with this mean field approach, we can calculate which is the lowest energy. Any bets? Who's voting for hedgehogs? Oh, someone knows the answer. Someone's voting for hedgehogs. If Stephen Julian's voting for hedgehogs, no one else is going to vote against. So here we are. Hedgehogs win. So that we really didn't know until we did a calculation. But it's also interesting to notice that as the number of particles goes up, so if you go from 10,000 to a million particles, the differences between those become smaller and smaller. So one answer to this is they tie in the thermodynamic limit. Okay, now the next thing we can ask about is to pull apart the energy and look at kinetic energy and potential energy and interaction energy separately and ask how they change as you go through the transition. And what you expect to happen is that the kinetic energy will go up in a ferromagnet, and that's the price it has to pay for reducing the interaction energy. And indeed, this is what you find. So looking at the energy versus this strength of the interaction, you find that at first, the interaction energy goes up, starting from zero interaction and increasing. Okay, you get a bit more interaction. Another thing that happens is this spherical trap starts to blow up, kind of like a balloon. You increase the interaction, and the potential energy goes up. And because the density is going down, the density is going down when you keep the same number of particles and increase the volume, that means the Fermi energy must go down, and so the kinetic energy is going down. And this trend continues until some magic point here, where KFA is pi over 2 at the center of the trap, and then everything turns around. Now the interaction energy is quenched as the kinetic energy is increased again, and that cusp here, we can confirm, is when the spins inside the trap are choosing to be either hedgehog or domain wall. Presumably hedgehog. Another signature that this transformation is occurring is to look at the loss rate. So I told you that the gas dies slowly by three-body interaction, but we also know that those three bodies can't all be the same spin. Because fermions that are in the same spin state don't collide, you have to start mixing the spins a bit in order to have a three-body loss. So we can predict using some simple scaling about what the total loss rate should look like, and as the interaction becomes stronger, as the scattering cross-section becomes stronger, you lose more and more and more, but then once you polarize locally, you start to lose less. So this loss rate signature is something you can look for in an experiment as well. Now, I think you all know the saying, for every problem, there's a simple, elegant solution, which is wrong. And as an atomic physicist learning condensed matter, I have to say I don't think this is anywhere more true than in condensed matter physics. And so the Stoner model, for instance, does not lead to ferromagnetism in one dimension, even though it, in the mean field you'd expect it to. All the same kind of scaling I just told you should apply. Lieb showed in 1962 that in one dimension, the ground state is never ferromagnetic, no matter how strong the interactions. And so you might ask yourself, well, how could it fail? Okay. Oh, wait, let me just also say, there's no proof about what happens in 2D or 3D, but the fact that it doesn't happen in 1D doesn't sound good, so you might start to worry. So how can this model fail? I mean, if you increase the interaction strength enough, shouldn't it always be, in the end, favorable to just polarize? I mean, how could that not be the case? And the answer is, well, you can't just increase the interaction energy forever. You can only increase the scattering length forever. And to think about that more carefully, you need to think about how waves scatter off each other. So now I'm trying to recall things that you may have learned in your graduate quantum mechanics course, that a cross-section for an L equals zero wave, for an S wave, is proportional to the sine squared of its phase, the phase shift after scattering, times something to get the units right, 4 pi over k squared. K is the wave vector, and by that I just mean 2 pi over the de Broglie wavelength. If you have a contact potential, the scattering amplitude can be written like this, 1 over a plus ik 1 over. And then if you figure out what the phase of that is, plug that into this formula, you find that the cross-section must be 4 pi a squared over 1 plus a squared k squared. And now we can take the limit of this as a goes very large, and we find that the cross-section for very high a is 4 pi over k squared. It doesn't diverge. So at first this seems a little strange, but there's actually some very simple logic to it. If two particles, let's go back to particles, move towards each other, if you increase the cross-section, you're increasing the chance that they scatter off each other. But there's only so much that you can do. I mean, once it's 100% chance that you're going to collide, then you bounce back. You can't do more than that. You can't do more than just bounce back. And that's when you've reached the limit of what scattering can do for you. That's unitarity, okay? And in fact, if you look at resonant scattering of any wave, of light scattering off an atom, of electrons entering a quantum point contact, in many different fields, you'll always find that the cross-section is lambda squared. Okay. So what we need is an experiment to answer this question. We can't prove what happens in 2D or 3D. We know that 1D fails, but you know, gosh, qualitatively, it seems like a pretty good picture. What I'm not telling you is that in the meantime, people were working very hard on lattice models, and much more is known about a lattice. We know that in the Hubbard model, there are lots of ferromagnetic ground states for very simple conditions. Some of those proofs were done as recently as 2 years ago. The experiment I'm going to talk about was done at MIT. This is a picture of the MIT team. And let me point out to you Taut Wang, who's a U of T grad. And where am I on this team? I'm the sabbatical visitor watching. So here are the people doing, and then here's the sabbatical visitor mostly watching and talking, sitting at the desk, thinking, and then talking. And the people I really want to point out are Guibong Zhou and Yeri Young Li. Those two people really did this experiment. It was their shift of this experiment, which runs pretty much 24 hours a day, that was taking the data on this. So what is done in the experiment? Here's a time series of the critical parameter in the experiment, which is this magnetic field tuning the interactions. So as a function of time, first there's evaporative cooling, which gets you to quantum degeneracy. Then there's a little bit of trap adjustment. The field is then ramped to the desired interaction strength, and it's held for a variable time. And also, in this point here, we choose either a weak interaction strength or a stronger interaction strength. And then there are two types of analysis which can be done. One of them is imaging at high field, and one is imaging at low field. What is hoped to be observed is that you start with a mixture, you crank up this field enough, and then you see this kind of local polarization form. And we'll look for that in just a moment. Now, what do I mean imaging? You start with a trap, which is pretty difficult to see, and sometimes it's useful to expand, so you drop this cloud. It expands under free flight, and eventually its radial size here tells you more about the initial velocity than the initial size. You take a shadow picture of such a gas. It's still quite dense after being expanded, and the typical optical density of this gas is something like 1 to 10. So here's what was observed. We look at the atom loss rate, which I told you was a signature of polarization, and as the interaction parameter, KFA, is increased, as expected, things get worse and worse as you approach the resonance, but then, after some critical strength, that loss rate drops again, which is surprising because A is increasing, and so this looks like a local polarization. Just reminding you what the theory for that looked like, we also predicted something that had a peak. Now, I'm going to show you several curves in this data. The one I'm going to discuss is the lowest temperature data. It was important to us to also change the temperature to see if there's some kind of phase transition occurring. And what you'll see for most of these curves is that all of these signatures, which look ferromagnetic, gets weaker and weaker as you go up in temperature. The next thing that was looked at is kinetic energy, and that means the radius of the cloud after dropping it out of the trap. The kinetic energy went down as the interaction strength went up because the cloud was expanding in the trap, but then there was a minimum. And this was really an exciting signature to see. There's very few explanations we could think about that would predict a minimum in kinetic energy as you increase the interaction strength apart from these domain formation. That means in this regime here, the Fermi energy of the gas is going up. Okay, and this is qualitatively what you would expect from this mean field theory, that the kinetic energy would have a minimum. Increasing the temperature from 0.1 of the Fermi energy to 0.2 of the Fermi energy to 0.3, 0.4, you can see that the minimum, the place at which the onset of ferromagnetism was occurring, creeps upward. And that is what you would predict from a theory when doing this at a finite temperature. Now, let me just say that even though this is 0.1 TF, 0.2 TF, it seems pretty cold. But if the Fermi temperature of a metal is 1,000 or tens of thousands of Kelvin, that would be a very hot place to be. In this case, I'm talking about 100 nanokelvin, 200 nanokelvin. A theory done by McDonald and collaborators at the University of Texas show that they would expect this type of trend, that the transition at which ferromagnetism occurs would go up as as the temperature is increased. You also need more interaction strength in order to make this transition. So that's what we're seeing here, the shift to higher interaction strength required to form a ferromagnet at higher temperature. The final signature we looked at was what the cloud size was. I told you the cloud is kind of puffing up as you increase the interaction strength, but it also is expected to turn around a bit. As you get to the transition, you're at a maximum, and then the cloud size relaxes a little bit. And you can see this in the lowest temperature data, but at higher temperature it's harder to see. So, let's see. Since this experimental observation, there's been a bit of controversy. And the key to that controversy is the following thing. We looked for domains. We looked to see little islands of polarization using a technique that should be able to see that, and we didn't see it. And so I would say there's a non-observation of domains. A pessimist would say there were no domains. And the distinction between non-observation and actually seeing no domains is a subtle one. It has to do with signal-to-noise. Okay. And what this means is that if those domains were small enough, then across the cloud there might have been thousands of domains, and so the average spin at any pixel in the camera's image might have looked like it was unpolarized. So for small enough domains, the shot noise of whether there was 20 or 30 domains within the pixel would look like the noise intrinsic in the imaging system. And so our observation is only consistent with ferromagnetism if those domains were hidden. In other words, there would have to have been, if you think about a signal to noise of 10 and a square root of n shot noise, more than 100 domains per pixel. There also might be a kind of projection issue. What if the domains formed in a perpendicular direction to our observation direction, then x would be projected onto a random plus or minus z. We did try to rotate that possible spin direction, so we don't think this is the case. Now, why might there be such small domains? One explanation to that is that we did this experiment very quickly. If I go back to this time series, if you look at this period here, this was a magnetic field held for between 0 and 16 milliseconds. And then a question is 16 milliseconds long enough to form a nice ferromagnet where everything is going to be relaxed to, for instance, the hedgehog state? So trying to answer that question, Eugene Dimler and collaborators did some theory, and what they looked for is what they pretended we quenched the interaction strength. In other words, we stepped it very quickly, and then they asked what would happen to the modes, ferromagnetic modes that grow. So this graph is impossible to understand. It took me several hours. I can't really explain it in a moment. What they find is for a certain range of parameters, they would have expected only a couple of Fermi length size domains, very small domains. And it could be that this is the explanation for our non-observation of domains. And then there are the skeptics. So this was the supporter. And then there's the detractors. No. The detractor would say, you know, I can make up a theory that has all of these experimental signatures without having any domains. Okay. And this is a wonderful physicist, Hui Zai, who I actually met when I went to Beijing last fall. And he showed that you can think of a kind of correlation, a kind of fluctuation physics, where up and down particles avoid one another. And so then as you increase the interaction strength, the kinetic energy will also drop and then grow as this type of correlation becomes stronger and stronger. Okay, let me just point out that there's a kind of free variable in his theory, and so he has to show all values of this free variable, and there's no one value that could fit our data. In other words, you know, this minimum will never match up with this maximum observed. So it may come down to quantitative issues. Maybe qualitatively, even though I told you we were excited because the mean field theory shows the same qualitative features, maybe it will come down to what quantitative all these measurements end up being. So I'm just about out of time now. Let me mention one more thing that is an issue here, which is that in addition to having atoms around, it turns out we had some molecules around. And the reason that's the case and the reason we did the experiment so quickly are linked. This repulsive state is not far in energy from the paired molecular state that I told you you can form at the same value of magnetic field. And so that means that instead of just having a repulsive gas of atoms, you might have a paired gas of molecules and a condensate. And the loss rate between one and the other of these states is unfortunately quite high, which is more or less why no one ever did this experiment before. We were actually pleased at how slow the rates were. It allowed us to do the experiment. Nonetheless, if you look at the number of molecules, which is the difference between every particle and the one particles we were sure were just atoms, there is a gap, and that gap is presumably due to molecules. It could be that something about this molecular physics is fooling us and mocking the signatures of ferromagnetism. The only reason that we're not so worried about it is that nothing dramatic is occurring at the same KFA parameter where we see a minimum in the kinetic energy, a maximum in the loss rate. There's really a sharp feature when nothing seems to be happening to the molecular population. Okay, so in conclusion, it seems that we are seeing energetic signatures of ferromagnetism when scanning across a Feshbach resonance in a repulsive ultra-cold gas. And this implies that itinerant ferromagnets can occur in a free gas with short-range interactions, something which is still an open question. If so, this is really the first study of quantum magnetism in cold fermionic gases, although there are some buts. But the lifetime of our gas was only 10 milliseconds, maybe not long enough to reach an equilibrium situation. Magnetic domains were not resolved, and we have some molecules floating around this gas. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and thank all my collaborators.